The following program for our audience of blind and print-impaired listeners is a production of the North Carolina Reading Service. I'm John Fetterson, and I'm here to read the Indie Week to you, independent. And this issue dated, May the 8th of 2025. All right, and we'll get right to it now with some good bit of civic information, particularly school boards and school budgets. Starting in Wake County, the Wake County Board on Tuesday approved a $2.3 billion operating budget for the upcoming fiscal year. To balance this budget, the system plans to make about $20 million in cuts, despite pushback from teachers, parents, and students. In a depressingly ironic twist, the budget vote fell on Teacher Appreciation Week. The Wake County School System administrators say the cuts are necessary because ongoing federal funding for public education is uncertain because of consistent underfunding at the state level. Wake County typically steps up to fill the school system's budget gap, but this year's economic turmoil leaves them with less latitude to do that. A slew of students, teachers, librarians, parents, and grandparents say the school system should start by asking Wake County for all the money it needs and negotiate from there. At Tuesday night's meeting, they took turns standing up and asking the board members for a no-cuts budget. Three board members, Cheryl Caulfield, Wing Ying, and newcomer Christina Gordon, voted not to approve the budget. The remaining six members who voted for it say they weren't happy about the cuts. Lynn Edmonds said after the vote, "I'm agreeing to this budget proposal, but I don't support it." So that we're all crystal clear about why we're really in this mess, the General Assembly is not fulfilling their constitutional obligation to fully fund our schools. Lindsay Mahaffey said, "We are in a very unique moment for education in this country where we have to make hard decisions. We're here to make difficult decisions. I'm here to pass a budget." Christina Cole, a special ed teacher and president of the NC Association of Educators Wake County chapter, told the school board that their decision felt disrespectful to educators. Cole said, "We know our work is cut out for us at the General Assembly. Why is our work cut out for us here, too?" When Superintendent Robert Taylor presented his proposal to the school board in March, he explained inflation is making everything more expensive right now. Plus, the school system is opening four new schools next year and is required by the state to give a portion of its budget to charter schools. To counterbalance those needs, Taylor proposed eliminating some administrative, nurse, and digital learning coordinator positions and reducing funding for school supplies. The board approved most of those proposed cuts last night, but made a few changes. They rejected Taylor's proposal to reduce spending on employee dental coverage, maintenance and operations, and Wake's 43 low-performing restart schools. Instead, they voted to adjust building temperatures by 1 degree and reduce teachers' local salary supplement, that's the pay bump they receive above their state legislated pay bands, reduce from 3% to 1.5%. "There's no way that I just feel justified allowing these supplement to be sacrificed," said Caulfield, one of the board members who voted against the budget. Gordon, who also voted no, said she heard teachers and families' messages loud and clear during public comments and could not support a budget that removes administrative support staff from schools. Cutting those roles increases the strain on already stretched schools and sends the wrong message, she said. The system budget, which is requesting a $40 million increase in local funding, now moves to the Wake County Board of Commissioners for approval. That board has its own cost-cutting considerations along similar lines of inflation and financial uncertainty. So the school budget will not be finalized until later this summer. Now this next article by Chase Pellegrini de Power talks about the whole triangle school boards across the triangle. They're facing tough math, brutal local tax reevaluations, ever-increasing costs of seemingly everything, and a federal government dead set on cutting costs. Local officials who oversee the triangle's four public school districts have spent their ongoing 25-26 budget seasons really worried about balancing the progressive priorities of affordability and strong public education. The tension was on full display this week at a joint meeting of Orange County Board of Commissioners and the two districts, Orange County Schools and Chapel Hill Carborough, that it funds. Commissioner Earl McKee told the assembled municipal overseers, "I want kids to get a private school education at the public expense because that's what the state constitution requires us to do. I'm just trying to reconcile how we are going to do this without further forcing people out of this county." Specifically, McKee was eyeing recent and ongoing tax reevaluations that have caused deep financial pain for Triangle residents as property values have shot up in recent years. Wake County's 2024 reevaluation saw property values jump by an average of 51% compared to 2020. Orange and Durham are predicting a similar value increase of about 50%. These value increases alone don't necessarily mean that residents will pay more in taxes. Property taxes are calculated as a percentage of the whole value of one's home, measured by the county, set by the market, but they do mean any decision to raise property taxes to help fund schools would be that much more painful for property owners. This puts local governments in a tough spot. Governments like businesses are paying more for the same services. A plurality of your county tax dollars go to fund the Triangle's public schools, and local taxpayers foot that bill for any needed expansion, improvements, or just continuation costs. Durham Public Schools, DPS, for instance, is facing an expected utility bill increase of over $200,000. Last year, the county handed DPS a historic $27 million increase, but warned that such a bump is not sustainable. One commissioner at the time voted against that increase, arguing that the tax burden was too much to ask of seniors and low-income people. Another then-county commissioner, Nimishina Burns, said, "We have consistently done this every single year, and the board that comes after us is about to inherit this horrible, horrible problem we're laying at their feet." Early in the budget discussions this year, Commissioner Wendy Jacobs warned DPS to restrain their expectations. Wake's superintendent is recommending $19 million in cuts for next year's budget, as I just read, citing insufficient funding at the state level, rising operating costs, and a state law that requires the school system to transfer an amount equal to the per pupil share of public school funding to charter schools. That is, the dollars follow the student. With students moving to charter schools and low birth rates keeping the K-12 population relatively flat, some districts have recently been forced to re-examine their teacher-student ratio allotment formulas. Of Durham's roughly $700 million budget last year, about $43 million of local taxpayer money passed through to charter schools, as the county has over 8,200 students enrolled in them. The draft budget will eliminate 112 teacher roles across the district as a result of that allotment shift, though there are currently 158 classroom teacher vacancies now at DPS. In March, about 30 Chapel Hill Carborough educators were told their contracts would not be renewed. A spokesperson, Andy Jinks, told the Indy last March, 4 or 5 years ago, even as enrollment numbers were dropping, some of the allotments were held harmless or stayed the same. But as the years have gone on, this is an example of where difficult decisions are being made to ensure the long-term financial health of our district. The districts were in part able to put off those decisions thanks to $3.5 billion in federal COVID-era elementary and secondary schools emergency relief funds. The state, though, was required to spend that money by the end of 2024, leaving boards ominously referring to the ESSER cliff as the money dropped off. And more help is not arriving anytime soon from Washington, D.C., where the administration is busy dismantling the Department of Education, which primarily helps fund child nutrition and special ed. Durham, Wake, and Orange have each cited funds already lost as a result of that vicious government-wide cut. The Triangle districts are also competing heavily with one another to attract staff at every level, driving up some costs. Until 2013, the state funded higher pay for teachers with master's degrees. Wake and Durham in recent years have brought that back at a cost to local taxpayers. In their expansion budget wish list this year, Chapel Hill Carborough listed $2.5 million for master's pay in order to compete with its neighbors, and Durham $1.4 million for further expansion. Well, Chapel Hill Carborough Jonathan Scott said this week, "We're finding ourselves losing qualified candidates to some of our surrounding districts because some of those districts have implemented a local master's level pay supplement." And bus driver pay follows the same route. In its expansion request, OCS listed $300,000 for bus driver pay, noting that starting hourly pay of about $17 lags far behind Durham's $19. But Durham, in turn, is seeking $400,000 to provide pay supplements for its own drivers after a year featuring a transit crisis that was caused in no small part by a shortage of drivers compounded by the appeal of 20 per hour starting salaries at Wake and Chapel Hill. At that joint meeting in Orange County this week, commissioners and board members debated the trade-offs of an increased budget. Is it worth raising taxes, which will impact the county's poorest residents, in order to pay for services like guidance counselors, who then help the county's poorest residents? Commissioner McKee said, "I appreciate the concern that everyone in this room has for the situation the schools find themselves in, and the county. The very last thing I want to be associated with is turning this county further old, wealthy, and white." Board member Vicki Feaster responded, "It's not becoming old, wealthy, and white. It has been old, wealthy, and white. We need to have a deeper, broader conversation because these minority populations in Orange have been declining for decades and decades." DPS, Chapel Hill, and OCS Orange County have all officially transmitted these funding requests to their county governments, with Wake set to follow it early May, as you just heard. And while a child's education is figuratively priceless, county commissioners have till the end of June to evaluate those requests and decide exactly how much that education is worth to their taxpayers. Well, let's go to Lena Geller and another unclear funding headline. This is unclear funding for the Durham County Farm Campus. It's a project, a long-awaited agricultural education center and incubator farm. It passed a milestone Monday as county commissioners received the final feasibility study for this 129-acre Orange Factory Road property. A presentation of the study revealed both ambitious plans and looming challenges for the project, which has been in development for more than a decade. County Extension Director Donna Rewalt, who presented this at the commissioners' Monday work session, alongside Derek Fleming of HR&A Advisors, the firm who conducted the study, said, quote, "We're at a transition point now. The study represents both the culmination of work and the beginning of new directions." The farm campus will function as an incubator for new farmers, providing plots of land, equipment, and technical assistance to help develop agricultural skills and businesses. The campus will also include post harvest education facilities where farmers can learn processing techniques. A shared commercial kitchen space for developing foods like jams, pickles, and sauces that increase the value of raw goods, and a, quote, healing garden designed as a peaceful refuge for community members. The feasibility study, which gathered input from over 100 respondents and nearly 60 focus group participants, determined that the project could succeed. The Orange Factory Road site, which the county purchased last year, is especially befitting for agricultural development because of its fertile soil, existing buildings that can be adapted for new use, and natural resources like ponds and wooded areas, according to the study. But between the lines of the optimistic presentation lurked concerns about funding. Fleming and Riewoldt repeatedly alluded to a dramatically changed funding landscape, noting that a USDA grant they had expected to apply for, quote, no longer exists. Fleming told commissioners, when we initiated this process, we were operating in a different environment than what we see today. We have to think more creatively about funding sources, he said. The study suggests the project will primarily rely on county funding, supplemented by potential grants and revenue from programming, but it does not address how to navigate the new funding constraints. Commissioner Wendy Jacobs asked how the county plans to fund the project going forward. Realistically, she said, we're going to face challenges with all the operating and capital costs. How are we actually going to make this happen? Fleming and Riewoldt said they were exploring alternative funding sources and had a couple queued up. Fleming suggested working with mission-driven foundations and philanthropic organizations, as well as considering revenue-generating community events at the site. Riewoldt said, one of the cool things about the farm campus approach is there's a lot of touch points. There's sustainability and the environmental aspects of this. There's the agricultural aspect. All of these things intersect, as well as economic development pieces. So I think there's a lot of sources, a lot of funders that are going to find this type of work compelling. The study outlines a 10-year rollout broken into three stages. The first phase would focus on essential groundwork, setting up the incubator farm, making safety upgrades, installing basic infrastructure. Second phase would expand farming operations, and the final phase would add a commercial kitchen, event spaces, and recreational features, including that healing garden and trails. By full implementation, the farm campus is projected to require 4 full-time staff positions, a program director, farm manager, education coordinator, and food facility coordinator. Commissioner Mike Lee questioned whether 4 staff members would be sufficient for the long term and asked, that's all we feel we need going out 10 years to manage this? Fleming responded the staffing plan was based on projected growth and would leverage existing county resources. The farmers themselves will handle much of the day-to-day work, Fleming said, with additional support potentially coming from maintenance contracts rather than direct hires. The governance structure presented in this study recommends placing farm campus staff within the county's Cooperative Extension Department, with a community steering committee composed of local farmers, food entrepreneurs, and community leaders. Fleming said next steps include securing funding, recruiting the steering committee, and sharing the site plans with the public. The feasibility study notes the importance of reaching immigrant and refugee communities, citing a successful model at the Good Hope Farm over in Kerry, where immigrants work quarter-acre plots. And Jacobs said this could be a wonderful opportunity to both benefit from their expertise and provide them with resources to succeed in our local food system. And now we'll switch over to a column by Sarah Edwards titled B. Boggs Allen Wants to Help More Kids Care About Houseplants. B. Boggs Allen. During the pandemic, as people latched onto homebound hobbies, houseplants saw a notable popularity boom, particularly among millennials. Around that time, Beatrice, that's B. Boggs Allen, also took an interest in houseplants, although as a kindergartner, she represents a bit of a younger demographic. At the time, her mom, the writer Belle Boggs, had brought home a few lackluster office plants that needed reviving. An interest sparked. Bea and Belle have since collaborated to put their experience and experiments into a book, Plant Pets, 27 Houseplants to Grow and Love, which was published last year. After a round of events last September, the pair is kicking off the summer with an author talk that's coming right up at Chapel Hill's Flyleaf Books on May the 10th. B, now 11, gestures at a windowsill behind her. I think more people should have a hobby like this. A pothos, mother of thousands, philodendron, and several other plants are on the table, sitting by a basket of knitting supplies. At the time of the publication, she had 38 plant pets in her bedroom. She explained, most of the time, kids my age are on their phones playing TikTok or Fortnite. During COVID, I think a lot of my classmates basically played video games. I never did that, and I think that's part of the reason why I can have a hobby like this and not immediately give up on it. I'm interviewing, writes Sarah Edwards, B. and Belle at their home in Pittsboro, where the duo are getting ready to drive to the North Carolina State Capitol, a box of giveaway tomato starts in tow, to join a protest organized by North Carolina Writers for Democratic Action. B, now a writer in her own right, is preparing to give a speech at the event. Belle and other writers will carry signs featuring words banned or censored from federal communications by the Trump administration. Belle teaches at NC State and is the author of several books, including The Gulf, a novel, and Mattaponi Queen Stories, book which, like Plant Pets, deal in the flora and fauna of the natural world. Plant Pets is published by Story Publishing. That's an imprint of Hachette that publishes practical books for self-reliance. And the book is indeed a great tool for kids who may want to foster curiosity and practice independence with a hobby. Adults who, too, have plenty to learn from the book, which took B and Belle to Triangle Nurseries, science labs, and even vets for research. Divided into three sections, the book's colorful illustrations guide readers through the do's and don'ts of propagating, planting, and nurturing specific house plants. Don't touch your Venus flytrap's trigger hairs. Do water your orchid when the plant feels physically light. There are also plenty of ideas for directions kids can take the hobby, from plant sitting services to making herb salt or aloe vera gel. B offers this. There are lots of easy-to-grow plants. Pothos is very easy to grow, but it might not work for certain people. You just have to kind of figure it out. And Belle adds, for a while, we were very into glass bottle propagation with the pothos, which is very fun because then you get to see the roots. We were on this kick where we had to drink Jarritos all the time so that we would have them. As an advice for kids, as for advice, who may want to get into plants or writing, B, who considers writing a book on knitting next, has evergreen wisdom to share. Don't give up, she says. I know it might be hard at first, but if you keep at it, you'll get really good, and it's a very rewarding hobby. Once again, this is at Flyleaf Books, May the 10th, Houseplants to Grow and Love. To Durham next for a couple of articles specific to that town, both by Justin Laidlaw. First, Central Park and other downtown Durham sites are coming up for a redesign. And Central Park is a 5-acre green space in the heart of downtown Durham and one of the city's most vibrant community hubs. It's the latest downtown mainstay, slated to get a makeover in the coming years. The project is part of a broader comprehensive plan for the Durham Parks and Rec Department, which the City Council will vote to adopt at its meeting on Monday, and other strategies in the works to make the most of the downtown spaces. Pardon me. In 2023, the city contracted with Raleigh-based civil engineering firm McAdams to provide planning and engagement consulting services, including the development of a plan for Central Park. McAdams has worked on a number of projects across the triangle, like Gibson Play Plaza, and is also leading the much-anticipated Durham Rail Trail project. Most significantly, this plan, developed through a multi-year collaboration between the City of Durham, Durham Central Park Incorporated, and McAdams, calls for leveling out a sloping green hill on the east side of the park that's sandwiched between Liberty Warehouse and the Vega. Other than using it for a rolling cheese race, the hill's steep incline has a restricted set of uses. Instead, the design team plans to create a great lawn with tiered seating and a space for a small stage to accommodate concerts and other events. Reimagining Mount Merrill, the playgrounding space that's often overrun with tiny tykes and toddlers every Saturday morning during the farmers market, is also high on the priority list. At a City Council work session last week, Shweta Nanikar, a representative from McAdams, says the expanded play area could potentially include a water park feature and other natural amenities around the creek nearby that kids could play on. Asking how can we create more of that nature play element for kids and families to experience the urban nature in this area. Other improvements include making entry points at the north, west, and south sides of the park more inviting, and redesigning the underutilized areas like the Sister Cities Grove next to Glass Jug and the small trail and garden behind Foster Street Apartments. Nanikar says the groups hosted a series of public engagements, including pop-ups at the park, open house site visits with subject matter experts, and a 3-day charrette, all in service of designing the most dynamic 2.0 version of the cherished community space. Participants voiced a desire for more inclusive and flexible public spaces, with better ADA access, integration of natural elements, and a more seamless and pedestrian-friendly transition between the various areas of the divided park landscape, particularly across Foster Street, which currently splits the park into separate zones. The half-block strip of Foster between Hunt Street and Corporation is routinely closed to vehicle through traffic due to a packed calendar of events hosted at DCP, notably the Downtown Farmers Market. The new DCP plan calls for installing retractable bollards and possibly changing the street's surface to give the section of street a pedestrian-first look and feel. Councilmember Chelsea Cook, who rarely shies away from trying to extract more from a development project, asked why the street couldn't be permanently closed to motor vehicles. Nanikar said the design team is working with the transportation department to explore different options, which include installing bike lanes as part of the city's bike and walk implementation plan. Cook said, if we're really serious about encouraging pedestrian space, I would lean toward cutting it down to no vehicular traffic and allowing other modalities, but of course leaving space for emergency vehicles. But plans for Central Park are just one piece of a broader vision for transforming downtown Durham in ways that encourage people to get out, walk, spend money, and participate in the community. This year has been a season of reimagining Durham leadership as they continue to try and right the ship post-COVID. In March, Discover Durham presented its annual report, which expanded on the organization's master plan and shared updates on Durham Next, the new nonprofit created to facilitate big ideas like a new convention center. And last week, Nicole Thompson, CEO of Downtown Durham, Inc., and Scott Page, principal at Interface Studios, presented DDI's Downtown Durham Blueprint 2035, a vision of how to revitalize the Bull City Business Improvement District. The plan laid out ways to engage the swarm of downtown residents who seem to be hibernating inside their apartments, simplify navigating the district by improving signage and making parking more accessible, and luring residents and visitors with attractive new and updated amenities. During her opening remarks, Thompson acknowledged that downtown Durham is not what it was a decade ago. Many businesses came and went as the market changed, new construction erupted across the district, and COVID lockdowns altered consumer habits, with more folks working from home and ordering delivery, even if they live in a high-rise within a stone's throw of Durham's best culinary offerings. DDI worked with Interface Studios and Youth Arts Collaborative Black Space to develop a blueprint and re-engage residents and visitors during the coming years. Like their peers at Discover Durham and Parks and Rec, DDI prioritizes building more pedestrian-forward spaces for in-person gatherings, highlighted by redesigning a series of disjointed plots along Mangum Street that currently include a parklet next to Luna, a swing set in front of a Black Wall Street historic plaque, and a city-owned surface parking lot. The new destination would be called Black Wall Street Gardens. The blueprint also looks at redesigns for Parrish Street and the CCB Plaza, creating a wider, more cohesive pedestrian zone. And, of course, the plan examines that downtown loop. Thompson said to a room full of laughter and jeers, "Is it really a master plan for the future of Durham if we don't talk about the loop?" Changing the loop has been running around in our collective minds for decades. It continues to be a racetrack around the middle of our downtown. It prevents the movement of people from the center of downtown to things we are now seeing in the north part. They cut across four lanes of traffic. If they want to go to the library, good luck. So it's a challenge and something I would love to see movement on. For all the consternation about the loop, it's not highly trafficked. Page said about 8,000 cars a day drive on the loop, way less than what a four-lane roadway was designed for. Page said this is fundamentally a trail project, and this is the opportunity to take something that's a highway and transform it into a trail. While the loop is the main focus, the blueprint also looks at strategies for the loop's extremities, Roxborough, Mangum, and Duke Street, which have been at the intersection of many conversations with transit advocates, downtown business owners, city leaders, and other stakeholders in recent years. Page reminded folks that, like those streets, the loop is state-owned, making them a key decision-maker in future loop plans, along with Norfolk Southern, that's the freight train company who owns and operates the railroad tracks that run parallel to that loop on Ramsar Street. While Durham now has an abundance of plans between its tourism agency, downtown business district, and city officials, but with the specter of economic uncertainty looming, how quickly can we expect to see shovels in the ground or paint on the road? Durham has elected four mayors since changing the downtown loop was first discussed back in 2009. The land for the Durham Rail Trail was purchased in 2018. Yet the project, barring any setbacks, isn't set to finish until 2028. That is a decade later. And Justin Laidlaw's second article about the new Bull Ride. And it'll cart you around downtown Durham for free. If you catch yourself in need of a lift in downtown Durham, maybe you've left your Broadway show at DPAC and need to jet over to Gear Street Garden to make your dinner reservation. Standing by the roadside and throwing up the iconic Bull City hand gesture, it could land you a trip to the Bull Ride, a new shuttle service from Downtown Durham, Inc. DDI rolled out a new fleet of fully electric golf cart-esque vehicles as part of a relaunch of its Downtown Ambassadors program. A six-seater operates as the Bull Ride on Thursday from 4:30 p.m. to midnight, and Fridays and Saturdays from noon to midnight, when a higher volume of patrons descend on that business district. Hailing a ride is as simple as flagging down a car in sight or calling the hotline 919-682-BULL. Trips on the ride are free and will take you anywhere within the Downtown Business Improvement District, which spans from Golden Belt to Brightleaf, and from 147 to roughly old North Durham Park. But don't expect to get a 30-minute tour of the city center. Extended rides are not allowed. Wait times vary depending on the time and day, just like Uber or Lyft. The carts are equipped with lights and speakers. It's not quite the shooter's party bus, but the DDI ambassador drivers get to hold the aux and curate their own playlists. It keeps the energy high, says Kenny Valenzuela, director of Clean and Safe at DDI. Demand for the rides have steadily increased since their launch, and Valenzuela says, it's not just a ride from one destination to the other. We want it to be something a little bit more fun, more of an experience. Now, Bull Ride does come with a few stipulations. You must be over 8 years old and over 80 pounds, and no pets except service and party animals. Smoking and drinking prohibited while riding, though, so you'll have to chug those bullpen social district cups before hopping on. In January, DDI and its Downtown Ambassadors program went through a rebrand. DDI switched from burgundy red to a new purple and white color scheme. The Ambassador program, which previously sported bright teal, adopted that same purple to create cohesion between the program and its parent company, making the Bull Ride easy to spot. It also serves as a safety escort for folks at night, particularly people working in downtown Durham, as aggressive panhandling has been a concern for business owners wanting to protect their staff and their customers. When DDI ambassadors aren't giving rides around downtown, they're making more frequent stops at businesses to get feedback on what's working and how to further enhance the district. Ambassadors also conduct quality of life checks with panhandlers and the unhoused population downtown, Valenzuela says. His team received training in de-escalation tactics and works in tandem with HART and the police department to help folks in need get access to services. And Venezuela says, HART does a great job, but they're dispatched. What our ambassadors provide is more visible presence by patrolling the streets. The additional service vehicles, that's a pair of two-seaters, allow ambassadors to cover more ground during a shift and remain a constant presence available to whomever might need them. Valenzuela says they're walking into the business and saying, hey, what's your experiencing? Do you have any safety concerns? Is there something we can do a better job of? Getting that information is critical. Valenzuela spent his career in venue management before moving to Durham from New Mexico to run DDI's ambassador program, which he says entails working with his team, business owners, and a number of city departments to improve the downtown experience. His team of ambassadors, 10 in total, are separated into two departments, cleaning and hospitality. The cleaning team is responsible for trash collection, at around 200 trash cans and supports cleanup after major public events, like last month's inaugural Biscuits and Banjos Festival. The team has two large pickup trucks in their fleet for cleaning and landscaping responsibilities. Valenzuela says the success of the revamped ambassador program will largely depend on the feedback from business owners within that improvement district. The program has only been around for a few months, but folks are already starting to take notice, he says. Quote, as soon as this thing launched, we got constant calls and emails saying, wow, we notice a big difference. Building that community is how we define success after just a couple of months. We are sort of building this program from scratch with a new team and a new company. Over to Lake Crabtree and Raleigh, Southeast Raleigh resident Michelle Lambert came to the Wake County Board of Commissioners meeting Monday evening with what she called a heartfelt plea: protect Lake Crabtree County Park from commercial development. She told the board during a public comment session, it's more than a park. It helps make Wake County special. It's a place to hike and bike, and families, workers, visitors, we all benefit from the trails, trees, and the natural open spaces. It's a place to breathe, to connect with nature. But it seems like a done deal. Wake County announced last week it plans to close most of those trails at Lake Crabtree County Park on Sunday, June 1st. Ahead of the expiration of its lease of the land with the Raleigh-Durham Airport Authority. That's an agreement that's been in place since the 1980s. The Airport Authority wants to use about 136 acres of the property for what it calls an entertainment district, a component of its long-term Vision 2040 master plan. Residents still think they can persuade Wake County's Board of Commissioners to save the parkland, however. Gene Spooner, chair of the Umstead Coalition, told the commissioners at this Monday meeting, you, the county commissioners, can protect the land. You have the power to ensure the last 30 years of community use of mountain bike trails continue. Spooner and several other speakers leaned on legal arguments to make the case that the county commissioners have the authority to preserve the trails. They emphasized that the same Board of Commissioners zoned the property for residential and highway use in the 1980s, and no state or federal laws have been enacted since that could change that zoning, despite the Airport Authority's ownership of the park. The authority says the Federal Aviation Authority requires it to make money off the leased land that it owns. Speakers disputed this point as well. An attorney for the local mountain biking group Triangle Off-Road Cyclists, or TORC, has argued that a fair market value exemption exists for community recreational use, Spooner told the commissioners. Protect your zoning, protect your flood control structure, protect the most popular county park in your county. Speaker Jessica O'Toole made a poetic plea to preserve the natural ecosystem of this parkland. To be able to easily hike and enjoy nature in such a vast forest in the middle of a city is truly a rare treasure. She added she and her husband, a birder, spend all of their free time walking the trails. Quote, we look forward to the haunting sound of the wood thrush in the morning and a chorus of 1,000 frogs at dusk. In the summer, we watch for the return of the osprey. We've seen otters scamper along the creek and beavers splash in the water. We've been chased by snakes and surprised by turtles. In the falls, thousands of spiderwebs glisten on the trees, and the variety of colorful mushrooms on the forest floor is truly spectacular. During the winter, we watch for the eagles. I have never seen so much wildlife. Speaker Seth Stansberry echoed comments about the importance of having recreational green space for residents' mental health and urged the commissioners to move to a month-to-month lease arrangement, saying, the park is very important to me and my family, and I think it's something we can't replace if we lose it. The park's lakefront facilities, including that boat launch and picnic areas, will not be part of the commercial development, according to the Airport Authority. Commissioners so far have not indicated that they do plan to step in to preserve the park, but residents plan to continue to appeal to them over the next month. All right, now I'm reaching into my Wayback Machine to go back to April the 21st, Lena Geller's little column called Lunch Money in the Queue at Durham's Queue Dogs. And she writes, in December, I set myself a challenge inspired by a 20-year-old episode of a Rachel Ray Food Network show. Could I get 3 meals, a snack, and a drink in Durham for under $40? That piece went over well enough that we're launching a regular series focused on budget dining. What exactly does budget dining mean in 2025? This has been the subject of a hot debate at the office. Depending on how the tariff situation shakes out in the future, the debate may be ongoing. Eventually, though, we landed on criterion for our ongoing lunch money column. 1 meal under $15, including a 20% tip. My goal is to secure a main dish, a side, and a drink whenever possible. Though the modern lunchscape may make this traditional trio a challenge, as restaurants increasingly focus on all-in-one entrees rather than separate components. Well, for my inaugural outing, I set my sights on Durham's Queue Dogs. That's Q-U-E Dogs, which opened its first brick-and-mortar spot in March. It's in the middle of the Lakewood Shopping Center parking lot, like a lighthouse in a sea of asphalt. The family, who owns Queue Dogs, has been selling hot dogs and barbecue from a mobile cart for years before finally settling into this permanent location. That's a spot with hot dog history, having previously housed City Dogs and the Doghouse. It opened on March 1st. Queue Dogs' claim to fame is hot dogs topped with pulled pork barbecue. But upon studying the black and red menu board, I realized the signature Queue Dog, $9, would push me close to my limit before even adding sides. I could go with the plain Jane, $5, a naked dog awaiting customization, or the Chili Billy, $6, with their house chili, but they seem too straightforward for this mission. The Q sandwich with barbecue and slaw, $7, seems most promising. I'm thinking maybe the sandwich, I say to the cashier, who introduced himself to me as Alan when I walked up to the ordering window. He confirms it's very flavorful and filling. So then they show the receipt. Q Dogs, can of soda, $2. Q sandwich, $7. Chips, $2. Subtotal, 11. Tax, 83 cents. Tip, 275. Processing, $1.17. And the total for her meal there, $15.75. For a side, I want the potato salad with bacon, $3. But with a $2 can of Pepsi, I'd be in nearly $14, which won't leave enough for a 20% tip. So I pivot to a bag of Lay's chips. I'm feeling good. But when the payment screen appears, I freeze. The tip options are 15, 18, and 25%. I could ask Alan to return to the previous screen with that total so I can calculate 20% on my phone. But the pressure of the moment, I panic and tap 25%. Grand total, $15.75. Later, I realize a 20% tip would have put me at $15.20, still over budget. Maybe this is why I became a writer instead of an accountant. After a 2-minute wait, Alan calls my name from the pickup window. There's a napkin and some hot sauce in the bag, he tells me. Before bidding me, let us know what you think and leave a Google review. I walk to my car and set up a picnic on my trunk. Before I can take a bite, I notice two people sitting in the bed of a white pickup truck nearby, nodding enthusiastically as they eat. Their enjoyment is so animated, it seems almost staged, like extras in a commercial, who have been instructed to look delighted by every bite. When I hear one of them say, "I feel like this is the perfect amount of food," I feel like I have to approach them. Their names are Lindsay and Nick, and they have a whole system worked out. Nick explains, "We do splitsies. One of them orders the number one combo, $14. That's two all-the-way dogs topped with chili, slaw, and onions. The other gets the number three combo at $18, two Q dogs topped with barbecue and slaw. Then they each get one hot dog from each combo. They also split the potato salad with bacon. Lindsay notes it has whole grain mustard in it. Back at my trunk, I unwrap my sandwich. It's a good weight in my hand, and the bun is pillow soft, yielding gently as I take my first bite. The flavor profile hits sweet tart notes, the barbecue offering a molasses sweetness, while the slaw provides a piquant counterpoint. Flecks of carrot and cabbage are visible in the mix, along with black pepper specks that add a nice kick. The sandwich remains intact throughout the eating experience, unlike some barbecue sandwiches that disintegrate halfway through. I've been there. This one maintains its structural integrity, allowing the flavors to blend with each bite rather than land in my lap. The Lay's and the Pepsi were, well, you all know what those taste like. I might have failed at staying under budget in my initial column, but Q-Dogs succeeds at what matters most, serving good food without pretense. I'll be back in a few weeks with my calculator app primed and the courage to ask for a custom tip amount. Social anxiety be damned. Well, if you're looking to IndieWeek for a specialized report, this next long article, which I may have to edit a bit, is titled "The Triangle Sword Guild Recreates Historical European Martial Arts." It was published on April 23rd. The sound of clashing steel rings out, interrupting an otherwise peaceful evening at Marsh Creek Community Center in Raleigh. People adorned in protective gear swing swords, their feet shuffling quickly in the spacious pavilion as they brace for their partner's next move. For an hour on most Monday evenings, they practice the centuries-old techniques of historical European martial arts. The center is one weekly meeting place for the Triangle Sword Guild's sword fighting classes. The nonprofit organization based in Raleigh reconstructs historical European martial arts, HEMA, HEMA, with a blend of scholarly research and martial training, according to its website. Andrew Eicher, the club's communications officer and a co-instructor of its advanced beginner Napoleonic fencing class, said, "What we're doing with HEMA is recreating lost arts, taking information that was written down hundreds and hundreds of years ago, depending on your time period of study, relearning how to fight and put into context back to that type of thing." HEMA is an umbrella term for various fighting techniques that encompass hand-to-hand combat, such as wrestling, and weapon combat, including fencing or a combination of both. It's a fairly new discipline, as most HEMA groups have existed for fewer than 15 years, according to the Triangle Sword Guild's website. Founded in 2009, Triangle Sword Guild is one of nine recognized HEMA clubs in North Carolina, some of which the organization has partnered with, like Warriors of Ash in Asheville and Sword Wind Historical Swordsmanship down in Charlotte. According to a 2023 essay, HEMA has experienced a surge in popularity following the pandemic, with HEMA practitioners reporting that their clubs and classes have doubled in size since then and continue to expand. Eicher said the Triangle Sword Guild's membership has experienced some mildly exponential growth. A few years ago, the club had approximately 50 to 60 members, compared to 153 as of March of this year. While HEMA is situated in contemporary times, Eicher said the Triangle Sword Guild's four core classes, That's medieval swordsmanship in the German style Kunst des Fechtens, Art of Fighting, Fior de Liberis Armisare, the Art of Arms, Renaissance Fencing, and Napoleonic Fencing. They cover a long stretch of history. The classes primarily focus on weapon combat, with some featuring hand-to-hand. They're hosted across various public spaces in the Triangle, including Raleigh, Apex, and Morrisville. Several groups branch off from the core classes, Eicher said. Now, looking through this article, and this is completely devoted to sword fighting, and based on our listenership, I think it's probably best for me to just let us all know that these places exist. IndieWeek.com is their website of the Indie Week that I'm reading to you from, and that is available online. So people who want to read or pursue these complete article, and this is a five-pager, can simply go there, and they keep their articles stashed for years and years and years. So I won't go into more of the details about jiu-jitsu and sword fighting and sabers, but I'll just move on. And in the couple moments left for me before I have to close, some of these other articles for you to find if you wish. The Time Is Always Now, an art exhibit. Artists reframe the black figure. That goes on until June 29th at the Museum of Art in Raleigh. It's a major exhibit that's on tour now. Then, as foreign aid workers want a stronger response from local leaders about losses mounting for the foreign aid establishment, and that was written on April the 10th. Also, a Durham rally at the mid-April against cuts to the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau for the usual Republican-based reasonings. And here comes my theme music, which says, "Get out of town, John." John Federson, that is. And get out of town now. But I warn you, I'll be returning in a week with my next issue of Indie Week to read to you from the North Carolina Reading Service.org. And we thank you very much for listening. And I hope you go to IndieWeek.com and pick up on some of these articles that I haven't had a chance to read to you. Well, I'll be with you next week. And so I'll say farewell from the North Carolina Reading Service.